One of the things I've enjoyed about your show, well, first off, it's my goal to put together a podcast for the Carroll Center, and I'm going to try to convince you to be part of it.
Absolutely.
One of the reasons I wanted to stop by here. Have you ever heard of a podcast called The Gilmore Guys?
Yeah.
I want to do a Gilmore Guys on blind tech.
That is a great idea.
I want you to be one of the guys, and I already got Doug Wakefield has agreed to be one of the guys.
Okay.
I'd like to get somebody like Greg Vanderheiden in the group, and get, say, four people who are pretty much regulars, and then three or four that come in and out as time and circumstance allow them to. And the idea is not to go in and start talking about, some of it would be, you know, current events as they apply to blindness tech. When the head of Pell Stata died.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of ramifications of that that nobody's talking about. And by the time anybody writes anything and publishes anything, it will no longer be true, you know? For example, when he died, the gentleman they put in to head the company, temporarily anyway, was the guy who ran, up in Canada called?
Visuaid.
Okay. Yeah. Now, what does that mean for the rest of us? Why do we care? What's your guess?
Just different way to steer the company,
certainly,
different philosophies.
However, they also both come having been champions of a product.
Oh, true.
And
true.
Russ Smith, that's what's his name, right?
Yeah.
His pet project was the PK. And he's gone.
And Gilles' pet project is Maestro.
You got that. So you don't think that's going to have an impact on the future of what products they push and when they have limited resources? That's all companies do.
Well, and you know, Gilles would be a good one to have on the Gilmore Guys.
Exactly. And the idea is to move it around a little bit. It's kind of trying to predict a little bit what's going on in the future, but also talk about, you know, the big grand topics.
Is the
Daisy book really going to be something that is going to fundamentally change the way blind and visually impaired people access books? What impact will the nature of the machine that NLS produces have on what RFB&D does and APH does? With APH taking on the central catalog, if you will, repository of textbooks, K-12, right? Electronically speaking.
Right, right.
What impact is that going to have on things?
Those are all...
These are all biggie issues
that
you don't
see
anybody writing about. And primarily because, well, I think a couple of things. One is, we don't have enough hours in the day to do what we already do. When are we going to find time to sit down and write it?
Mm-hmm.
Especially if it's speculative pieces as opposed to, funded...
Hey, Lee, how are you? That's why we're out here.
It's a nice place to have a meeting.
No problem.
That's my idea, that we would, the Carroll Center, I would act as the host, make sure that we all have a topic, make sure the tech all works for us to come together by way of Skype.
Mm-hmm.
I've purchased the, whatever that thing is called, Skype Outlook or whatever, that is the plug-in.
Oh, to record.
Record a five-user session kind of thing.
Yeah,
and I think I can get enough people who can wing it on Skype. I'd rather it be Skype than something like, Talking Communities, for example, because I like the interchange that happens in a Skype experience where two people can talk over one another a little bit and get involved in that rather than somebody holding down the mic button and...
Well, before we get too much further into this conversation, let's tell our blind cool tech users, I keep calling them users, listeners, that we are here on September 30th with a special guest, Brian Charlson from the Carroll Center. And we're sitting at a picnic table outside of APH right now on a gorgeous fall day. Fall finally hit in Kentucky. Welcome to Kentucky, Brian. And I understand you're here for an ACB board meeting?
That's right. ACB has we'll call it an early fall board meeting before all the state conventions start happening and the national board members have to go off to be the guest speaker at state conventions. And this time around, it's here in Louisville, Kentucky, because one of our members of the board, Carla Rushaval, a native of Louisville, has set up an opportunity for us to take a look at the Galt House as a potential site for our 2008 convention.
Oh, we'd love to have you in Louisville.
I tell you, Louisville in July, though, Larry, it's not like this gorgeous day in
That's
September.
That's what air conditioning's for, man.
I remember my first convention, ACB convention that took place here, and we came over to do a lovely tour of APH, and I felt so bad for the guys out in the plant working those steam presses.
Yeah.
Oh,
phew. Oh, was that back before it was all air conditioned?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It certainly was before the days of air conditioning in the plant here.
Oh, man. There's a long row of, there's an atrium all through the middle of the plant that they used to open up in the summer to let air go through there, and it stays closed all the time now, but I can't imagine being back there in July.
With no AC.
Yeah.
Oh, it was amazing. So, it'll be nice to come back again. It's certainly nice to be here this time of year, you know. Today here feels just like it's supposed to be in Boston today.
Well,
mid-70s.
2 days ago, you wouldn't have said that. It was 95 degrees here, and then all of a sudden, it just cooled off overnight. Literally.
Now, this is pretty. This is pretty nice stuff. I was delighted that the room I have has a door to the outdoor, so I'm going to take a chair out and sit out there when I'm between meetings and the like during the next couple of days.
Great. And tell us about your, or Jake's buddy there, Brian.
I have Keegan with me. Keegan's a 9-year-old German Shepherd from the Seeing Eye. He's my third male Shepherd from that fine institution.
And I
should also tell you, Larry, everybody's been remarking on my tie today.
Because,
I've got a guide dog tie. I've got dogs all over this thing. German Shepherds, of course, being slightly partial to that particular breed. My wife and I, she's Kim Charlson, she directs the Perkins Braille and Talking Book Library. She's also a guide dog user. And I have to tell you that when I was listening to the podcast of you giving your two dogs a bath,
yeah,
I drug her into my home office to sit down and just have a chuckle over that, because we've all experienced it, haven't we?
Oh, the shake.
Oh, heavens yes, heavens yes. I have a swimming pool at my house, and every once in a while during the summer, one of the dogs will, as they're racing around the concrete apron around the pool, will take an unscheduled dip.
Exactly.
They get in, they come straight to a human being, and then shake.
Could they
shake at the other side? No, they got to come up to you to share the experience.
Do you know, my two German Shepherds would not touch, they would not go near the pool, and they couldn't stand to see anybody swimming in it either.
Oh, our dogs, my dog goes ballistic seeing somebody go swimming, so I don't have him out there when I'm in the pool.
Yeah.
My wife's dog, on the other hand, all she needs is an invitation, and she's airborne. She's into that pool, and she swims. This guy, the few times he's fallen in, I've had to scoop him back out again because he has what I call a lead butt, boy. I mean, he dog paddles with both paws out of the water, slapping that water and barely keeping afloat. So in the other one that I really enjoyed of your podcast, and again, I can feel it. Like I said, we feel your pain, was you were going on one of your famous walks to work, and smack, you got it in the face with this tree branch because it had rained the night before and all the branches were hanging a little bit lower. And you're saying,
I
got to be careful about these. What?
You've been there.
Been there, done that many a time, many a time. I tell you, I haven't quite taken to carrying shears out with me because some of the branches I come in contact with require those big old scissor-shaped lopping shears,
right?
Down, not the little hand ones. But that we've enjoyed those parts of the podcast. I know there are those podcasts when I go to listen to them, I really want to have 15 minutes of hard-hitting content. That's not why I listen to yours. I get my tech mixed with a nice bit of relaxation and enjoyment, and I really do like that mix. It's very Larry, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I'm glad you do. I've sure been having a ball doing them. And how
you find the time. And I, that's the other thing I was telling my wife, that she says, how are you going to find the time to do a podcast, Brian? I said, well, one is, I know that the more we work in kind of middle management of our organizations, the less we're going to work 9 to 5, and the more we're going to work, 7 to 7.
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
The nature of the game. And so I'll just schedule the creation of my podcast for that hour after everybody leaves, but the boss is still at work. With you, it sounds to me like if you didn't get to do it on the way to work, we'd lose out on 45 minutes of a fun chat and an interesting tech sidelights.
Oh, I try to squeeze one in anywhere I can.
That's
man.
Right. Well, let's be careful now. One time you squoze a little too tight, as I recall.
I did. I unsquoze it that one.
Oh, but let me tell you, that day I was downloading podcasts onto my bookboard because I was once again hitting the road. And so I saw that you were, in fact, in the process of uploading all of your podcasts. So I took a moment. This was when you had come back from your vacation in Arkansas, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so you came back, and apparently you were uploading quite a few at one time in a batch kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And so I download a couple, and my iPodder is going .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. .. downloading them on, and I take them with me. I had to go to a meeting on this whole business of the closing down of the RSA regional offices.
Uh-huh.
There was a conference held by RSA, and supposedly we were going to get a chance to talk about it there. So I ended up going down to D.C., and my wife, who I mentioned before, works for as the director of the Perkins Library at the Perkins School for the Blind. She had to come down for an NLS meeting. So I'm taking this along with me, and when I get to our friend's home we were staying at for the 2 or 3 days, I looked at my email, and there was all this brouhaha about Larry's latest post. And it was so fun to read it and see all these people getting themselves all worked up over nothing.
Yeah, and, it wasn't that bad.
Oh, no, for heaven's sake. Compared to the daily download?
Right.
Come
yeah.
on, get perspective. I'm not sure that I am the master of my book port. So to get to that scene, to double check what I had apparently hadn't heard yet, I, you know, there was a lot of fast-forwarding to try to get to that particular part of the podcast. And we all sat around laughing about it and saying, you know, now we know Larry better than we ever thought we would.
I actually haven't told my dad about that yet.
Give him time. You know, it all gets quiet in the long run. And then, of course, Jonathan Mosen's wonderful post during that course of about a week. We're just so hilarious. He's such a master of the pun.
Oh, he was laying a few puns on me when we were doing our interview.
Yeah, there. On what's his, the Mosen Explosion?
Yeah.
There's a podcast that's not something you slip into your pocket to take along for 15-minute listen, is
that's
it?
A big one.
That's a big one. So I didn't get a chance to put that on lately. Well, I'm glad that I got a chance to come in and see you here. I want to, because I've seen APH twice, and each time things become more modern here, like you had mentioned, the air conditioning.
Yeah.
Certainly that's one of the modernizations. But I think, again, on one of your podcasts, while you were doing your detour through the bowels of this place to get to your office, you were talking about they're rebuilding a couple of sections for...
You know, as a matter of fact, I just came through that on the way to see you for the first time since it started, because all the workers are gone. I just wanted to see what it was like, and it's nice. It's a nice hall through there, and I didn't realize there was glass doors at the end of the hall, so I probably...
And this is going to be the home of what?
Attic and, you know, the Accessible Textbook Initiative.
Right.
And the new Accessible Tests Department that Debbie Willis is heading up.
That's excellent. So,
it'll be good to have some nice neighbors like that.
This organization really tries to keep up on being up on the new tech without abandoning the old tech.
Yep, exactly.
In the process. That's always
a great
impressed
place
me
to
about
work.
This.
Yeah.
Now, I have to tell you that that in addition to stopping by to see you, I'll see if I can stop by to say hello to Tuck. He and I have shared a few, I should just stop with the word, shared a few. But we were on the World Blind Union North American Region Board for a number of years.
Yeah.
And so we shared some time down in Grenada.
Oh, awesome.
At one meeting. And also in Melbourne, Australia, for one of the quadrennial conferences and the like.
Well, we'll just do a sound-seeing tour up to Tuck's office then.
There you go. There you go. So I want to stop by and see whether or not he's found a local outlet for glava.
A glava. Now, what is that?
Glava is a liqueur made up of a blend of fine scotches and some honey and a little bit of herbs.
Sounds.
And it's like sipping whiskey.
Sounds
it's
awesome.
Good stuff. A friend of mine from Canada first brought it to a meeting I attended, and once Tuck got a taste of it, we both started looking for a U.S. distributor for the stuff. And so far, the best I've been able to do is anytime I do cross the border into Canada, pick up a few bottles and stash them away for later.
Now, I want to ask you about something we talked about a few weeks ago, and I don't know if you can say anything about it or not, but maybe you can. When I was heading to Dallas, you were heading up to the Perkins Institute for a meeting about the redesign of the Braille Writer.
That's right.
Say anything about that?
You know, what they always say, you know, I'm under non-disclosure, but I can give you some general ideas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think the most important thing that people have to understand is that Perkins as an institution and Howe Press as a subdivision of that institution feels an incredible commitment to all of those who own Braille Writers at this point.
Right.
So before anybody worries that they're going to abandon the Braille Writer, there's no way they're going to abandon the Perkins Braille Writer as you and I grew up with it. However, I can also say that they've hired a new plant director. And this guy comes to Perkins not from the blindness field, but from electronic and mechanical engineering and manufacturing.
Okay.
And as a result of that, he looks at the Braille Writer and says, this is one incredible device.
I was
remember
surprised.
What number of parts are
600
in one of
these something, I heard
outrageous
recently.
Number of parts, all fairly fine tools
yes.
as well. Custom bits and pieces in there. It's not like they're taking... I was thinking back when I was just out of college, I worked at a place called Drake, Woolick & Smith that made kidney dialysis machines. And I was responsible for building the heaters that kept the blood at an even temperature as it was going through the dialysis process. And the piping we sent it through was PVC piping for sewage systems.
Well,
the heaters we used to keep it warm were heaters used in northern climes to make oil warm enough to flow in home heating systems. And the cords to plug it all in came from a vacuum cleaner factory. That is not the nature of the Braille Writer. Every part is a Braille Writer part.
Yeah, yeah.
The springs are twisted to a particular strength and all that. None of that's going to be abandoned. It's just too amazing of a machine. But it's acknowledged that in a day and age where you and I, while we have Braille Writers, and we use Braille Writers, I have one on my home desk and one on my office
desk.
I
do too.
I would never give it up. The fact is, it's competing with Braille Note Empowers and Packmates and...
Well, sort of.
Those kind of things. For note-taking.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that a lot of people who used to own 2 and 3 Braille Writers have downsized to 1.
Yeah.
And those kind of things. So if you were to look at what needs to change in a mechanical device like a Braille Writer that would improve its basic features, what are the negatives of a Braille Writer?
Well, you know what? I can expound on this quite extensively because I've thought a lot about this. Working where I do and being right next door to the Kentucky School for the Blind, seeing these kids hauling these Braille Writers around that are just about heavier than they are.
So, number one is weight.
And size.
And size.
You know, you want to have something the shape of a notebook so they can slip it in their backpack. Lightweight plastic. Let the paper slide through a different way than it does now. Maybe front to back. Or back to front, either way.
So the way I look at it is, one, we've got to find a way to reduce its weight. It's ridiculously heavy.
Well, it's,
absolutely,
what is it, pot iron?
It
was designed in 1952,
now,
wasn't it?
Sure. Most of the parts today are either aluminum or steel.
Yeah.
Neither of which are known for their light weight in that quantity.
Right.
But you take a look at the housing, which is cast aluminum, and you say, does it have to be that thick? Does the housing have to be made of aluminum? Or could it be made of one of these high impact plastics that are out there, the ones where they mix polymers and and fiberglasses
exactly.
into something that's sturdy enough for you to shoot with a rifle and and not break it. So I would say, one, we're going to see, I used to say in my lifetime, but in technology and engineering is probably much before that. I'd be surprised if in 5 years we don't see a wholly new Braille writer coming out of Howe Press Perkins, and it's likely to take advantage of all of the lighter weight components.
And don't you think it still should be completely mechanical?
I am of the opinion that it ought to be mechanical. That's one of its positive
exactly.
aspects.
Exactly.
Not all of my life has to plug in or require
right,
a battery.
As much of a techie guy as I am, there is a place for a mechanical device.
Absolutely. So I agree with you. One, we got to reduce the weight. What is that thing now? 12, 13 pounds.
Is that what it is?
For something like that. And there are places where there's full plate metal in there.
Yeah.
Where in modern manufacturing, they would drill out some of the unnecessary for structural strength components. There are some solid bars within it.
Yeah.
That with modern technology could be hollow bars. Same structure in the interim. I would imagine we're going to see Perkins do two things. One is modify the existing Braille writer to reduce its weight without hurting any of its durability. That I think can be done without redesigning from the ground up. And another is engineer a wholly new device that keeps in mind the idea we want reliable quality Braille.
What about the shape of it?
That would have to be part of it. Everything in design these days is lighter, stronger, smaller.
More ergonomic.
And more ergonomically laid out. Now, I have to be honest with you, I do not like ergonomic keyboards, Larry. I don't know if you're an ergonomic guy or not, but I grew up with my fingers in a row, and by God, I like my fingers in a row.
I don't mind them that
okay.
way.
But when we talk about ergonomic, we're talking about rounded edges. Keep in mind, you've got to move this thing from place to place. One of the things that my friends and I have been talking about, and I'm not talking about directly in the I can't talk about what we talked about kind of thing, but we've been talking about, where's the handle on Perkins Braille Writer?
Yeah.
It's on the top of the thing.
Yep.
So that when you're carrying it, you can't hold it against yourself. You got to kind of reach your elbow out there for it not to bang against your hip with every step. I've carried mine by picking it up by, what do they call it, the keyboard apron that sticks out.
Yeah.
If you hold it that way, up and down.
That is actually a lot
then
better
Then it's
way.
Flat against your side. And in fact, if you get a chance, go pick one up from that and imagine just reshaping that so that it's more of a handle grip than its current shape. And, and see if that doesn't improve its carryability. Wouldn't require a whole new design, but I think it has some real potential. I don't think everything they've ever done to the Braille Writer has been an improvement. Do you have a unit that has O-rings along the gripper bar?
I do.
Put in there originally, put in there as a modification to hold cardstock in place when you wanted to write on something, right?
Yeah.
And I says to myself, self, depending on what those O-rings are made out of, and I'm not a materials engineer, it may limit the lifespan of a Braille writer for that kind of soft rubber. You know, I'm sure that it won't be nearly as catastrophic a thing as when the O-ring
right.
on the shuttle, but it's still an O-ring. It is still an O-ring on there. We said size, we said weight. Two other negative aspects of the existing Braille Writer to
the amount of pressure you have to put on the keys. It could be, I think, with some leverage,
you could probably
improve that quite a bit.
I think the noise it makes.
The noise, that's a good
one. If you're
one.
A blind kid in a public school banging away at your Braille Writer, I mean, there's no way that this is a subtle experience. And the sound dampening inside of a classic Braille writer is mostly felt padding.
Oh, is it?
And while felt padding doesn't deteriorate like some substance do, it packs down.
Yeah.
And so the longer you use it, the noisier it gets. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't bounce back like rubber and those kinds of things do. It packs down the more you do that. So I think that we'll see some sound dampening efforts in the redesign of the existing one and any future one that they do. And I guess the other thing is the price is pretty outrageous.
The price is bad.
The price is bad.
What are they now?
Well, they're in the upper 600s.
Okay.
Now, I don't know how much it literally costs to make a Braille writer versus what it takes to, what they sell it for.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems clear to me that price is becoming an object. And if we want to promote Braille literacy everywhere, then price is a serious issue. Overseas, Perkins was able to get a grant from the Hilton Foundation, or the Hilton Hotels, to underwrite the cost of Braille writers when manufactured and purchased in the third world. But you and I don't get that benefit, so we're not getting Braille writers under $500. I think out there they might even get them under $400.
Wow.
That led to that bit of controversy you may recall with Maxi-Aids and importation and all that business.
Oh, yeah.
So, I would say if they could drive down the price, bring down the weight substantially, streamline how it does its job, make it a little jazzier looking, to be honest with you. It looks like it's done by a German engineer, doesn't it?
It does.
The only...
From the 1950s.
From the 1950s, exactly. I mean, this is the same guy who, you know, built the Sherman tank, this thing.
Or the
right?
Volkswagen Beetle.
Exactly, exactly. And, then, you know, they did this recently, I guess. They've come out with it in two new colors.
Yeah.
A shade of blue and a shade of green.
I don't even know what was the original color.
It's kind of a putty gray.
Okay.
Like the old PC putty before they switched everything over to, what do they call it now, platinum.
Right.
That kind of thing. But, you know, when you're a kid, I'd like blind kids to be as excited about having their new Braille writer as sighted, or blind kids to be as excited as sighted kids are about getting a new iPod, you know?
And, you know, just to give some background to people that may not be familiar with Braille writers, you know, it's really the only tool you can use to label, like, your important papers. In fact, I use it for that more than anything. Contracts I want to keep in my files, any kind of papers that I want to keep around, any kind of documents that are on paper. Labeling CDs, well, no, I use a slate for that, that's true. There was a Dynatape adapter for the Braille writer at one time. Is that still around?
Still around, yeah. And Perkins sells it. It was originally, I think, created in Spain. I don't know whether ANSI had anything to do with it, the Spanish Association for the Blind, but it was created in Spain and was shown around, and now it's manufactured here. It's strictly a piece of metal, sheet metal, with a 90-degree turn that allows you to slide it in where the paper would go in a Braille writer, but it acts as a stopper to keep it from sliding in too far. And it has a couple of pinch clips on either end that allow you to stretch Dymo tape for about, maybe 8 inches or so, and be able to Braille on it with the writing head of the Braille writer. It's a great little device.
It is.
I wish that we could come up with some new great little ways to do it. I saw something the other day I thought was kind of interesting. Somebody's created a reading table that you, again, attach to the back of your Braille writer. It kind of hugs where the margin sets are located.
Okay.
And allows the paper to come out, as it already does, flat, but to lay on a table so you could read the Braille.
Okay.
Without having to slip a second hand under it to give enough strength
to touch it.
That's kind of a neat idea. I wish Perkins would go out and do a contest to colleges and universities. Come up with add-ons for our traditional Braille writer that would give us some added value, like that Dymo guide does.
You know, I wish, I don't know why they couldn't make something where you slid the paper in from the front and it just went straight through the machine so that it actually laid on the table as it came out anyway. the device would be a lot flatter.
I think that the device of tomorrow has got to be flatter like that. And I agree that we've got to find a better way to do paper handling.
Yeah, that's quite a contortion that goes through.
Sure it is. I mean, how many devices can you think of where you have to... And think of all the mechanical parts that must be required to roll it to a particular point, pull open a lever, slide paper in, have it snap down with enough pressure to hold it in place as you roll the whole piece of paper into the Braille writer, gauging when it's gone in far enough but not too far. Yeah. That's one of the things that always goes on my Braille writers. Eventually, I have to have them take a look at it because it rolls all the way in, and I get to spend a half hour trying to fetch that piece of paper back out of it.
Yeah.
And then to start bringing it back out in a very precise amount with each carriage return in the process. That's got to have lots of moving parts in there to accomplish all of that.
Part of those 600 and some odd parts, pieces, I'm sure.
You know, you think about the simplicity of a typewriter, what's it called, a platen or something like that, where you put the paper behind and through friction it holds it in place, rolls it through, and yes, you still bring it up a certain amount each time, but it's not being wound up and then unwound to put something on it. Couldn't you take that same mechanism, same idea of it anyway, and instead of having the paper go in from the top and then back up vertically, mount the whole thing horizontally, have it come in from the back, roll back out the top, each time coming in from the back and going back out through the back, so that you're not having to reach under the paper to reach the keys to do the embossing. The difficulty, of course, is going to be that the way the Braille writer currently works is pins reach up from under the paper and punch into that little printer head thing. Well, if you got paper, two layers of paper, somehow you've got to get all this mechanism to come in from the sides.
Well, or why not put the paper in the front under the keys? And, well, no, that's right. Then you'd be punching down, wouldn't you?
You're punching down. And we've all seen efforts to try to create kind of, what do they call those things, reverse slates?
Yeah.
Where you push down with a dimpled-nosed stylus onto a pin, and the Braille is not very good, and all those kinds of things. But I have to think that since the day the Braille writer kind of met its final design spec, that there's been material improvements, there's been mechanical improvements that could cause us to not have to give up the quality and durability of the product and still be able to affect those things like weight, size, price, and noise level that really limit how people are willing to use a Braille writer. You know Otis Stevens, don't you?
I don't.
Okay, Otis is former president of ACB, and the reason I bring up his name, he's I think, a head of the political science department at University of Tennessee, and he's the fastest Slayton stylus user I've ever seen in my life. He went through Harvard University, if memory serves me correctly, and he takes a magazine and sets it down on the table, puts his Slayton stylus on there, and starts Slayton stylusing across. And even then, imagine that next to you all the way through a complex lecture. I mean, he does it at such speed that there's inevitable volume that goes with that. I mean, it's not a quiet experience, even with him attempting to pat it down a bit.
Tell us about what's going on at the Carroll Center, Brian.
Oh, let's see. Those who have heard about the Carroll Center over the years know that we're a private, not-for-profit rehabilitation agency. Started about 50 years ago or so by Father Thomas Carroll, who was active in teaching blinded vets and wanted to take the same kind of techniques and apply it to those who didn't happen to be blinded as veterans, but the general public who had lost their vision. And about, I guess now it's 22 years ago, the Carroll Center applied, along with a number of different organizations around the country, for some federal funds to see if maybe this newfangled home and office device called a computer, whether blind people could be taught to use it in a way that would improve their opportunities in education and employment. It was us, the Cleveland Sight Center, and a place called CTEC out in California, who were the first three grantees 3 years of money, go prove that you can do it or can't do it, and then we'll see. When the money ran out, CTEC, as it was then constituted, shut down. The Cleveland Sight Center had a gentleman who was one of their trainees, a Mr. Storer, who was a fairly well-to-do gentleman, come from a fairly wealthy family. I think they own a chain of FM radio stations throughout the Midwest. Decided that he would be willing to give some grant money on an ongoing basis to keep that operation going. And we kept ours going on a fee-for-service basis, where 70% of our costs are covered by fees for the service. And the other 30% we do like all the other not-for-profits do, fundraise. Mm-hmm. So nowadays, 20 years later, I'm now the director of the program, and we have a brand new $2.5 million tech center that includes some nice dorm rooms with broadband internet connection in them, 100-seat capacity lecture hall with all the AV you could possibly ask for, including, you know, a 50-inch plasma screen and a 10 by 12 foot projection screen.
Y'all trying to get in? Just go up that ramp right there and around the corners, the front doors. You need some help?
Give me a little guidance.
Sure.
Around this.
Yeah.
Stay out of his way there, Keegan.
Yeah, you got it. Right, there's a...
Over here?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh. You got it?
Just keep hugging that wall on your right as you go up the ramp.
You're gonna take a right when you get to the end of the building, and just follow that all the way, and you'll get to the front doors.
Just get in Larry's way, Keegan. Come back over
there. So, he's wagging that tail.
Yeah, he's happy. He's not having a bad time here. He's enjoying a bit of out of doors.
And I think him and Jake are nose to nose down there.
Saying, oh, we got to listen to another one of these podcasts. Anyway, so we do traditional training, face-to-face training, where people come to us and we have skilled instructors who teach them to use JAWS and Window Eyes and Zoom Text and Magic, Kurzweil and Open Book and all of the note takers and PDAs and Braille translation software, embossers and the like. In addition to that, where we train them where we are, as well as sending our instructors out to teach people in their homes and offices and schools on an as-needed basis, we're now mostly spending our time and energy inventing in the area of distance learning.
Oh.
So we've created a website called caroltech.org, CARROLLTECH.org. And we're now, in fact, today is the end of our second full year of the project. We've created what I think is one of the finer examples of accessible website design. I hired away from MIT a web designer who is an absolute fanatic about standards and will not allow any workarounds on his site, thank you very much.
Well,
and as a result, it's accessible.
Excellent.
And we've learned some things along the way, and we keep fighting ourselves not to stop and go back and redesign, although we just finished two or three major parts of redesign. Anyway, so we have this website, and on this website, an individual can go and become a member just with an email address and giving us a name to tag on to things.
Uh-huh.
And then you can come back and you can take a qualifying quiz. It's a 50-question, multiple-choice qualifying quiz intended to determine whether or not you have the necessary computer skills to actually learn anything on the net.
Okay.
That you have enough knowledge of email, sending and receiving attachments to send and receive homework, that you have enough web browsing to be able to access web-based content for reading and watching videos and these kinds of things.
Okay.
And that you have enough knowledge of word processing that you can accept handouts electronically and read them and modify them as your personal notes and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
After you've done a qualifying quiz, and we're not very persnickety about it. It takes only a score of 70 on the quiz to qualify. After you qualify, you can then take, we have posted up there a free course this course is on how to use the public access catalog used by more than half of the nation's Braille and Talking Book libraries.
Oh, okay.
I don't know whether Kentucky is in that group. Have you ever heard of the Keystone Library Automation System?
I have.
CLOS. So this works for the CLOS public access catalog process. So in those places where this particular system is used, you can learn to go on and check out your own talking books.
Okay.
See what you, what they say you have in your has nows, and what you have had over the years in your has had file, etc., etc.
Hmm.
So we have a free class on that, and then we have a series of classes that to the end user cost $100, and each one is about 36 hours worth of content. Now, I know that you've had to work out the what we can afford to do and what we can't afford to do, Larry,
right,
in your job here. And I don't think that you would say that $3.60 an hour for access to something is a particularly steep price.
Not bad, not bad.
So, and naturally, that's kind of underwritten by grant efforts and the like. But you go on here and you sign up for a class, let's say, in Intro to Excel for JAWS users.
Okay.
And there's a series of 12 lessons that make up that course, and each one has a clear set of objectives, a bulleted list, followed by some text that's the equivalent of the chapter on the subject of that particular lesson,
mm-hmm,
followed by a series of 3 to 5 short videos. Now, these videos, in the case of a JAWS class, would have the voice of the instructor, the voice of JAWS speaking, actually doing the tasks that the chapter was all about. So it might be about controlling the width of columns in an Excel spreadsheet.
Okay.
And it will have a video on how to widen it or narrow it, use the auto fit, how to determine whether or not it actually needs widening, those kind of things in video form. So you read about it, then you watch slash listen to it happen. The video, by the way, is the actual instructor screen at the time the video is created.
Nice.
And then you move on to homework exercises. And the exercises might be download this file from the website, click here to download, open it up, and tell us as in an email where you send us back some other work, which of the salesmen in the spreadsheet made the most in the month of February.
I see.
So we can find out whether or not you, in fact, do know how to navigate,
mm-hmm,
according to the lesson.
Boy, those must be quite a job just to keep those all up to date. Well, huh?
It's a constant. Of course, when you're at the intro level, there's not that much difference between one version of JAWS and the next, one version of Excel and the next. There,
yeah,
have been times when we run into some pretty big differences, such as PowerPoint.
Yeah.
The difference between PowerPoint 2000 and PowerPoint XP at the intro level is virtually nothing. But between XP and 2003 is the dynamic change, because they threw in the task window.
Right.
That superimposes itself over almost everything you do. So we had to actually create two versions of that particular course at the intro level.
Okay.
We offer these courses. Oh, I should say there's two other parts to a typical lesson. There's always going to be the quiz. See how I did on this subject. It's a 10-question multiple choice quiz, and you get your answers. When you click submit, you get a return page immediately that tells you what your score was, which questions you got wrong, how you answered them right or wrong, and in fact what the right answer is. Because our goal is not to try to trip you up,
right,
but to try to teach you. So we take that attitude about it. If you're taking these courses self-paced, you're done with that lesson, you move on to the next one. If, on the other hand, you want to take it what we call instructor-led, then we use the iVocalize product,
mm-hmm,
with scheduled times for each lesson where the instructor and students can come together and have a chat about the content of that lesson and any previous lessons.
And we should tell people about what is iVocalize.
iVocalize is an audio chat utility put together by the people over at TalkingCommunities.com. I think it's .com, isn't it?
I think so.
I think it's a .com. And it allows individuals with a headset with microphone to go to a particular website, type their name into a name field, and press enter, and suddenly they're in a conference call without the benefit of telephones. A person holds down the control key to speak, releases the control key to let others speak, and everybody who's at that site at that time can talk to one another.
And it works quite well, I might add.
It's an incredibly useful product. We certainly have people who can't come at the time that the courses have their one-hour chat session for each lesson. So we record them, again, using the iVocalize utility. We record them and post them as an archive, and you can go back and listen to them at your will. And we do this for 12 lessons over the course of, if it's a live system, then we do 2 lessons a week over a course of 6 weeks, knowing that almost none of us have ever finished a course on time, Larry. We actually give them access to the online content for 120 days.
Okay.
The self-paced ones, you have access to it for 120 days, and you have email contact with your instructor. There's links there to send in your questions or send in your assignments to the instructor and the like. So we have classes on Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook, the Duxbury Braille Translator, Accessible Graphing Calculator.
Oh, do you? That's a nice
TGD
program.
Pro. For creating Braille graphics. Keegan, no, you may not go say hello to that yet another dog.
Hey there, Charlotte, what's up? Oh, that's right, you get off at 3:30 today, don't you? You lucky dog, you. There's another dog out here with us today.
That's right, his name is Keegan, and he's from the CNI. I'm Brian Charlson, down from Boston, Massachusetts. You good? Just look, don't touch Keegan.
Charlotte's got a pretty new dog.
Where's she from?
Are you from Rochester, Charlotte, your dog?
Southeastern.
Oh,
what's her
okay.
breed? A black lab.
Name Angel, nice. Isn't it?
That's a pretty name. He says, oh, it's a pretty girl again.
Charlotte and Angel were on our bowling league last year.
And how do you do it, bowling?
She did good.
I got
good.
Some horror
she
stories about good. My early days in bowling. You haven't gotten a strike in the wrong lane yet, have you? You got a ways to go.
I got a strike out of the gutter once.
There you go. That's good. That works.
So how is the acceptance? Have you had good a lot of participation on these online courses?
I've had more acceptance of them from teachers of visually impaired using them as a way to get up to speed to work with their kids than I have from the blindness community.
I'll be darned.
We just looked at the stats, and during our second year, people signed up for 320 seats among our course content.
Okay.
Which is wonderful. However, probably more than 60-70% of those seats are TVIs.
Mm-hmm.
We actually use the online courses because we teach a master's degree course at UMass Boston for TVIs, teachers of visually impaired. And they have to take part of the Duxbury course as part of that course. And they've taken TGD Pro and Accessible Graphing Calculator from that as well. A number of them have taken Excel and PowerPoint and Outlook. Most exciting things when I see people do it, though, is when end users take the time to do it.
Yeah.
We have an odd situation. This, I'm going to wax philosophical, and I apologize to our listeners in advance for this, but we're so used to getting things for free that when you say to somebody, hey, I found a way that you can control what training you get because the price is only $100. $100 to take a course. If the state agency sent you for that same course to a place like the Carroll Center, it would cost that state agency $1,500
right.
for the same content. But you know, we have to jump through all kinds of hoops to get rehab to do things for us. We have to prove that we need it for work or need it for school. We can't need it because of self-improvement. We can't need it because it would be useful at home. We have to need it for employment or something leading to employment. So I thought that if we could keep the price down, we would have a lot of people would take that opportunity to take control of their lives in with respect to access to training. And it hasn't been as much as I would like. I think part of the problem is that I've been so involved in the creation of this, between myself as kind of the idea person and our webmaster, Mark Sadecki, who makes the website happen, gives us all the tools to hang the content from, and Joan Marie Diggs, who is our curriculum developer, who writes the lessons and quizzes and does the videos. You know, we put together a pretty impressive product, but we haven't had time to get out and tell the world about it.
I was just going to say, I don't know that that many people know about it. I certainly didn't, and I would...
I am
usually
signing
be one
up
that
to present
did.
It every conference you can imagine.
Well, good.
ATIA, Closing the Gap, CSUN, AER, ACB, NFB, state and local. I mean, I am the talking man right now with our stuff. And the minute I think I know what we're going to be doing, it changes. We've been very happy that we've had a couple of agencies say, you know, this will allow my little agency to offer some computer training.
Oh,
so we're
idea.
Creating a beginner series, mm-hmm. which is intended not for you to do on your own, but for you to do with a local instructor who doesn't have, you know, who might be the Braille teacher, the computer teacher, and the home ec teacher, all rolled into one.
Exactly.
And they don't have enough time to create all this content. So we create the content that will teach you the beginning of Word, of Outlook Express, of Internet Explorer, of Windows Explorer, and of navigating the desktop. And you go there, you go to, maybe it's a public library where they're trying to promote, you know, public access to information, or maybe it is a rehab agency that where a rehab teacher would like to assist somebody in doing it. And they can help you get through those to a point where you can then start taking these other classes on your own. We've been lucky, we've got some serious interest from the Miami Lighthouse for the Blind for this model,
mm-hmm.
The Oregon Commission for the Blind, the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind, I can't remember their name now.
Sight Saving.
Those are the entities that simply see the introductory people, and like you were saying, how do you keep up with this? Everything's got to require continuous change.
Yeah.
We can't all afford to invent it. So if we get a few of us who are in the development of the content and a lot of us taking advantage of that content, I think we're going to see it really go well.
I think that's a tremendous approach. Hey, you want to go see if we can barge in on Tuck?
Let's see what we can do.
Let's do it.
Sounds like a winner to me.
You waiting on your bus, Charlotte?
Yeah, it doesn't come until at 4:30.
Oh, is that right? Well, you got a pretty day to wait anyway.
Machine just the other day because I used a thing called a Gilligan kit.
Wow. I hadn't heard of that.
Hey, this is in the Carroll Center.
There
he is.
Right there.
Hello, Brian.
How long have you been here? Oh, we've been doing a recording of a podcast here.
Oh, is that right?
With Larry. How you doing, my friend?
Doing well. Good to see you. How's Kim doing?
She's doing very well.
Great.
Doing very well. She's up keeping the home fires burning while I'm down here for an ACB fall board meeting over at the Galt House.
Great.
So I thought
that
I'd come back
great.
And give Larry a bad time and see what he was up to. And then
wonderful.
Stop by to harass you for a
good,
moment just to
good.
Say hello.
Good.
I was telling him about some of the exotic places we've gone and grumbled about.
Gosh,
you know?
We have. Too.
We sit
and
at these tables at these meetings complaining about everything together.
One of the places we went to in this ungodly place is called No Problems Hotel.
Kind of like
that tell you something to start with, so no problem.